route to Stella's docking bay. Part of Perkins had been hoping the Giraptha would naturally take on the burden of command after wakening, but Ernt was perfectly happy for Perkins to be in charge and apparently saw nothing odd about a human commanding a Ruhar ship. Despite Ernt's knowledge of technology far beyond Ruhar capabilities, he was not much help with the battered toaster. After an assessment that had his antennas drooping with despair, he agreed with Jin that the ship's one functioning reactor would shut down when its containment system failed, and there was nothing anyone could do about it with the equipment available. After initially being stunned and thrilled to see part of his ship had survived, Ernt was equally pessimistic about the condition of the Dielmian. The reactors were basically scrap. Vented plasma had eaten into the backup power systems, and the engines that flew the ship through normal space were scrap. The only bright spot was the Star Carrier's jump drive system, for the coils and capacitors had come through the battle in fair condition. "The Star Carrier's jump drive is intact?" Perkins traced a finger along the schematic of the Star Carrier on the display in front of her.
"Yes, remarkably so,"
Ernt agreed, his antenna bobbing up and down vigorously.
"Unfortunately, that is of no use to us. The jump drive control system was in the forward part of the ship, part of the navigation computer. We do not have any system to control the action of the jump coils."
"Arlon Dahl," she used the Giraptha's rank to address him. "Is there any way for this ship's drive system to control a Giraptha jump drive?" Ernt's antenna stood straight up in surprise and he looked away, perhaps embarrassed for the primitive human who asked such a foolishly ignorant question.
"No."
Jin also was dismayed by being asked such a ridiculous question.
"We don't have an interface with the..."
"Yes,"
Tutula interjected with confidence.
"The ship does have a capability to interface with the Giraptha jump drive."
Ernt and Jin just stared at Tutula, blinking slowly. If she had suddenly grown another head, they might have been less surprised.
"How do you know that?" Perkins asked, glancing between Ernt, Jin, and Tutula.
"One of this ship's former officers told me about it. This is one advantage of being a member of an enemy species."
Tutula twisted her lips in a horrible version of a smile.
"The Ruhar are always very happy to show me how superior they are. Your people,"
he addressed the remark to Jin,
"have of course been studying Giraptha jump drive technology every chance they get, particularly when your ships are attached to a star carrier. Each of your ships is equipped with a working computer model that emulates an interface with the Giraptha jump drive. Whenever a star carrier jumps, your ships simulate controlling the jump to test the accuracy of the model, and your fleet studies the results to refine the model. The officer who revealed this to me bragged that the emulator is now believed to be 96% accurate. He wanted me to know that the shortcomings of your jump drive technology are caused by hardware deficiencies, not by the lack of theoretical understanding or inability to program a drive controller. The Ruhar,"
now she looked at Perkins,
"know that Kristang jump drives are shamefully inaccurate. That is a failure of the warrior caste, not of my people. The warrior caste pays too little attention to anything not directly related to destructive power. My people,"
she switched back to glaring at Jin,
"would correct that error.
If we could interface our drive controller with the Giraptha system."
Jin's voice trailed off as she considered the possibilities, looking to Ernt for a sane voice to squelch an idea that must be mad, but the Giraptha only looked at the display pensively, not noticing her. "The route to Stella can attach to the hardpoint?" Perkins asked, pointing to the one remaining docking platform that remained on the Star Carrier's shortened spine. "The Star Carrier jumps and we jump with it?"
"We can attach manually, yes."
Jin scratched the back of her head.
"I think so. Unless the clamps there are damaged. Colonel, even if we can control a Giraptha jump drive, we have no way to feed power into their capacitors. Physically, there is no connection between our reactor and the Star Carrier. I don't see any way to create a connection."
"It is not possible,"
Ernt muttered, his claws flitting across the controls, considering the question.
"No,"
he concluded.
"Colonel Perkins, my specialty is power generation. I am not an expert on propulsion or jump drives or computers, but this is my area of expertise,"
he declared with confidence beyond his few years of training.
There is no equipment aboard either ship for creating a stable power connection between this ship's reactor and the Star Carrier's capacitors. The input frequency of the capacitors is...
He blinked, looking around as if just then realizing he was in the presence of three alien species.
Well, that is not a specification I can discuss with you. I can assure you the capacitor charging system is delicate and requires a specific...
Yes, fine, I accept we can't recharge the Dielmian's jump drive. What is the charge in those capacitors now? Perkins interrupted.
We don't know. I suppose we could determine that with our sensors,
Jin added, embarrassed.
It is...
She waited while the damaged sensor suite responded.
81% charge. That is an estimate, you understand. The Giraptha do not give us specifications for their systems,
she added with a guilty glance at Ernt.
82% is the correct number. I do not think I am giving away any secrets to tell you that,
Ernt confirmed with one eye on a display.
Our last jump was only medium distance, I think, so there was plenty of charge available when we jumped in here.
Understood. How many? No, wait. Not how many jumps. Perkins realized she had been about to ask the wrong question. How far could the Dielmian jump with that charge?
I do not know, Ernt admitted without embarrassment. As I explained, I am a power technician. It is not possible, I think, for a single jump to use up that entire charge. The greatest power drain I remember from a single jump used up 34%, and that was with the ship burdened by carrying an entire heavy battle group of our own fleet. A series of jumps to use up the capacitors.
He rubbed his antenna together as he thought, in a gesture Perkins found fascinating and distracting.
Again, I do not know. It is a complicated question with many variables.
Colonel, the charge in the capacitors is certainly not sufficient for us to travel 16 light-years, Jin guessed. If you are hoping to get back on our original flight path, in case the fleet is searching for us.
What I want to know is where could we go? The young Ruhar cadet was unhappy about being asked questions she could not find the answer to in a shipboard database.
That also is a guess.
Yes, yes. Show me a radius of 10 light-years to be conservative. Jin adjusted the display to show a sphere around their present position. To Perkins, it disappointingly still looked like a whole lot of nothing inside that sphere.
That's it?
Are there any habitable planets, data relays, refueling stations in there?
No,
Jin shook her head.
Except for what we suspect is a Theranin sensor station here. This was Theranin territory until recently. If there is a sensor station, it would be automated and of no use to us.
Of course, Perkins reprimanded herself for allowing her frustrations to show.
Wait, what is this?
She pointed to a glowing gold circle.
That is an Elder wormhole, but it leads to space controlled by the Kristang, the Ruhar cadet warned.
Space that was controlled by the Kristang,
Tutula corrected.
Reports indicate they were pulling back from that area, even before their latest civil war,
she noted with disgust that her people would regularly kill each other over trivial matters.
They had few assets in that region, and the Theranin have abandoned that entire part of the sector after their recent defeats by the Giraptha,
she added the last with a nod to Ernt, who lifted his head with pride.
I'll take your word about that, Perkins muttered.
Can we go through that wormhole? If we can, what is on the other side, which we could reach? Show me a 10-light-year radius around the other end of that wormhole.
It is possible for us to go through the wormhole,
Jin agreed unhappily. It took her a few minutes to pull up a star chart showing the other side of that wormhole, as the ship's navigation system had to retrieve seldom-used data about enemy territory.
Here, she announced when the display filled in. Two star systems with habitable planets.
She pointed at two dots on opposite directions from the wormhole.
The closest one is Kormat. The report says it has an estimated population of 300, but that data is 20 years old. Kormat was a logistics base that fell out of use. The fleet thinks the Kristang pulled it out of service.
She looked closer at the data.
Kormat may be on the margin of being considered habitable. It is a very cold world.
She shuddered at seeing some of the climate estimates.
The Kristang live there in domes under the ice, and the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere is low.
Too risky. Too many ifs. Too many lizards. Perkins concluded without thinking she had just said lizards in front of Tutula.
You said there is a second habitable planet?
Yes, in the other star system.
Jin peered closely at the data and gasped.
Colonel, you know this place. You have been there.
I have?
What? Your people designated this planet as Camp Alpha.
Holy shit.
Emily Perkins did not have fond memories of that godforsaken planet.
The goddamned lizards are still there?
Jin searched through the data.
No. Fleet Intelligence does not think the Kristang have maintained a presence there after your people shipped out. That planet was the property of the White Wind Clan, which suffered a severe loss of fortune, then recently was absorbed during their civil war.
How sure is Fleet Command about Camp Alpha being abandoned?
As a career intel officer, Perkins would dearly love to see the raw intel take on that subject. How many times in her career had she published an assessment based on what she thought was solid gold intel, only to be proved wrong by the messy facts of reality?
The report... It...
Jin scrolled down through the data, then held up her hands.
It doesn't list a confidence factor.
We are certainly not going to the first planet you listed, Cormut, or whatever it's called.
Camp Alpha, god damn. Never thought I'd ever be setting foot on that.
She paused. She was describing a planet she might be asking the entire crew to land on and live for an undetermined length of time.
That world... Oh, hell.
She forced a laugh to lighten the mood.
It has oxygen, and the temperature isn't bad. No dangerous native life.
From what I remember, even when the Kristang were running the place, their footprint on the surface didn't cover much territory.
Her mind raced to remember how much land area the X-Force base on Camp Alpha had covered. At its maximum, the force that left Earth had consisted of about 120,000 people, with the U.S. and China contributing 35,000 combat troops each, and the other three nations providing 15,000 each. Support and headquarters units and observers from other nations had rounded out another 5,000. One time only, she had been aloft in a Buzzard aircraft on a familiarization ride above Camp Alpha and gotten a bird's-eye view of the sprawling but temporary base and the much smaller and walled-off Kristang facility nearby. From 80,000 feet up, the base had looked unimpressive, and she recalled another officer telling her the entire base plus wargame training area occupied less space than the state of Connecticut. Since the planet was mostly land with only 20% of the surface covered by oceans, that left a lot of room to conceal a single ship full of cadets.
I'll consider Camp Alpha our best option until I hear otherwise. How long until we can jump?
Colonel, I have no idea. I've never seen this emulator model.
She looked to Velt Tutula for help.
I did not know such technology existed until today.
The way she tilted her head, the cadet did not appear to fully buy into the idea of her people having ability to control a Giraptha jump drive.
I have never seen it either, Tutula admitted. Colonel, can you access it?
Emily Perkins had absolutely no idea what she could and could not do with her full set of command codes. She had never tested the limits.
There is not an icon for magical Giraptha jump drive emulator.
She regretted her sarcastic tone. When she was asking others to do the impossible, she should not be bitching about the pressure on her. The real problem was she felt she could not ask for help with simple tasks because that would display her profound ignorance. But she had no choice.
Something like that would probably be highly classified. Anyone got any suggestions?
I do not think the existence of the emulator is a deep secret,
Tutula noted.
The officer who told me said the Giraptha know about it.
She chuckled. A dry wheezing sound that caused a shiver of fear to shoot up Perkins' spine.
He said the Giraptha were probably wagering over how close the emulator is to their own system. Colonel, could it be as simple as searching for Giraptha jump drive emulator in your command codes?
It's worth a shot, Perkins observed as she typed the phrase into the handy search box, and presto, there it was.
Huh.
She looked up at Tutula.
Good guess. I'm allowing engineering and the pilots access to the emulator. What I would like to ask the Giraptha fleet right now is what are the odds this will work?
No one had an answer for her, but Ernt was twitching his legs in an agitated fashion, and the tips of his antenna were quivering.
"What is wrong, Arlandahl?" Perkins asked with concern. "You think this emulator will not work? Or would it make you uncomfortable for us to attempt to control one of your jump drives?"
"No, Colonel. It is not surprising that a client species would seek to understand our technology, and I will assist with the necessary connections, for I wish to live."
He twisted his mouth parts in a smile that somehow was less creepy than when a Kristang made the same gesture.
"It is just," he sighed.
"What?"
"Wagering whether a Ruhar system could control one of our drives is incredibly tempting action, and I cannot register a bet out here in the wilderness."
The alien crewman looked so anguished at being unable to participate in the favorite activity of his species, Perkins almost felt sorry for him.
"Arlandahl, we have a broken ship staffed by inexperienced cadets attached to the even more broke-ass end of a star carrier. To get to a habitable planet, we need to jump several times without the ship exploding, transit a wormhole into enemy territory, and probably travel a long distance through space to land on a planet that may or may not have a Kristang presence. So I will bet you that we will never set foot on Camp Alpha."
Ernt's antenna moved in unison excitedly.
"What odds are you giving?"
Perkins had no idea, so she made up a number that sounded good.
5-1.
5-1? No points?
No points, Perkins offered, guessing that points were a bad thing.
"That is..."
Ernt began with enthusiasm before his expression became downcast.
"That all sounds good, but I suspect you have nothing to wager with, and also we have no way to properly register the wager."
"Arlandahl," Perkins grinned, "we will be dropping off flight recorder buoys before we jump. We can include details of the wager in the buoy databank. And think about this. The only way we can reach Camp Alpha is by getting this emulator software to work properly. I believe the Ruhar fleet would be more than happy to cover my side of the wager to learn their software is functional."
"Oh," Ernt brightened, his mouth parts moving rapidly. "In that case, I want 7-1.
Deal.
Perkins held out a hand, and Ernt held out a leathery claw, and they shook. It took another 10 minutes of negotiating back and forth to finalize the wager, with Perkins arguing only because she felt Ernt expected her to.
"Excellent, excellent," the very happy Giraffa declared. "Now, show me this emulator system. I am not a jump drive specialist or navigator, but I do know about the power input requirements. It may be necessary for me to tweak the emulator settings so the drive does not explode."
Chapter 15. Perkins knocked on the frame of the hatch leading to the auxiliary helm, interrupting her two pilots who were engaged in a heated but quiet discussion about something.
"Strebich, Bonsu, everything squared away with you?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Irene lowered her voice with a glance toward the open hatch. The hatch had been jammed and needed to be cut away so Irene and Derek could get out of the auxiliary control center. Now the hatch was permanently open, and anyone lurking in the passageway could hear them talking. Derek understood why his fellow pilot was being so careful, and he unstrapped from his couch and floated over to the hatch. Sticking his head into the passageway, he gave her a thumbs up. Any listening or recording devices the passageway once contained would have been destroyed in the battle that had bent the heavy hatch. The Auxhelm had a flight recorder that stored all instrument, visual, and sound data, but Derek had learned how to temporarily disable that system, and he saw Irene had selected the pause mode.
"Colonel, it looks like if this emulator system works as advertised, we actually do have a decent shot at getting the ship to Camp Alpha, we think. It's risky, but our best shot."
Perkins nodded, so Irene continued.
"Before you arrived, Derek and I were discussing that we now have a star carrier. Is there any possibility we can get to Earth from here?"
Perkins groaned inwardly. She had enough complications to deal with.
"Strebich, you're the pilot. You tell me if we can get there. I thought the wormhole leading to Earth is shut down, dormant or something."
"That's what the hamsters told us, yeah."
Irene lowered her eyelids in suspicion.
"I found Earth on the star chart here."
She tapped the navigation display in front of her couch, letting her finger rest longingly on the symbol for humanity's home world. Then she tapped the symbol for Camp Alpha.
"The trip would require going through multiple wormholes, but there may be a possibility we could get there.
We won't know until we jump the first time and see how much that drains the Star Carrier's capacitors.
Perkins looked without any enthusiasm at the complicated proposed course that would take their busted half-ship deep into enemy territory.
Does that star chart show the wormhole leading to Earth as active?
No. Irene highlighted the symbol for that now dormant elder wormhole.
Not according to the chart, but you have a full set of command codes.
I was thinking, what if that wormhole is not really shut down? The Ruhar did tell us they have no idea why that one wormhole shut down all by itself. That doesn't sound kosher to me.
It never seemed right to me either.
But we don't know anything about how the Elder Wormhole Network functions, Perkins cautioned her pilot.
You're asking if my command codes reveal a different star chart, one showing that wormhole is still active?
Irene nodded silently with an anxious glance to the hatch, and Derek motioned her to continue.
Something like that, Colonel.
Biting her lip and clicking through the screens on her Z-phone, Perkins found the mode to transfer the phone screen to the display in front of Irene.
Navigation data is... somewhere.
Here. Perkins allowed herself a smile of satisfaction at finding what she wanted on the alien device. Ruhar systems were not as intuitive as they could be, or maybe they just weren't intuitive to humans.
Doesn't look any different. She frowned with disappointment.
It is a little different, Derek noted from the hatchway. That group of symbols in the lower left corner weren't there before.
Huh, you're right.
Irene zoomed in that section of the display.
Looks like our hamster friends have been holding out on us. This shows star systems recently surrendered by the Kristang, where the Ruhar fleet has conducted stealth surveys.
Does that help us? Perkins asked.
No. We couldn't risk flying to any of those systems, and we don't have the range anyway, Irene declared.
Going back to the question, the answer is no, dammit. Your star chart also shows that wormhole to Earth is shut down.
If I put my intel officer hat on for a minute, Perkins mused, I guess if anyone was lying to us about that wormhole being shut down, it's the lizards.
The Kristang told us that wormhole was shut down before the Ruhar fleet took Paradise back. I can't see the hamsters have any reason to lie to us about it. But the lizards did. What I don't see in this chart is the data source. Like, do the Ruhar know that wormhole is shut down? Or are they only taking the Kristang's word about it?
That's a good question. But it's academic right now, ma'am.
Derek kept his own voice soft, continuing to scan the passageway. Unless we, meaning our beetle friend, find a way to recharge the Jarap-the-Jump capacitors from the ship's reactor, we will run out of power long before we reach that wormhole.
Irene, look, I would love to fly back to Earth.
His tone indicated the subject had been argued extensively by the two pilots.
We need to concentrate on surviving first. Let's not get distracted, okay?
Strebich, good initiative on asking that question. Perkins patted the pilot's shoulder as she wiped the classified navigation data from the screen.
If we see an opportunity to...
Cadets coming, Derek whispered from the hatchway, and the conversation ended abruptly.
Very well.
Perkins turned to leave.
Ping me as soon as you're confident about the jump solution.
About that, Colonel, Irene raised a finger.
We aren't doing anything to get the jump programmed. That's the cadets, and mostly Tutula. Without her, we'd be sitting dead in space. When we're ready, I'd like to offer her my seat.
You don't want to be the first human to make a star carrier jump?
Perkins was surprised by that.
I would only be pressing a button, Irene explained. Tutula has been busting her ass. She deserves a chance to make the jump.
Plus, Derek added without a wink or grin, if the drive goes kaboom, it will be all her fault.
Well, there is that. Perkins also did not see anything humorous in the situation.
About that. Make sure we include the jump calculations in the drone we'll drop off before we activate the drive. If their fancy emulator software doesn't work, the Ruhar need to know about it.
All right, Strebich. I'll inform our Verdgris friend about your offer.
I want you looking over her shoulder the whole time. Someday we may need to do this on our own.
The Deomian jumped. The ship did not explode. Pieces of it did not go flying off in every direction, and the Rue to Stella stayed rigidly clamped to the docking platform.
Status,
Perkins asked anxiously from her awkward position strapped in next to Irene behind the two pilot couches. Unlike their jump in to find the star carrier when the displays had gone from empty space to space filled with broken ships, this time there was nothing on the display to tell her where they had gone to, where they were now.
"Sensors are working on it, ma'am," Derek reported with a look at Tutula to let the alien know that Perkins was not blaming her for the lack of data.
"Captain Bonsu is correct," Tutula agreed. "Our sensors were blinded by spatial distortion of the jump field. We need 7 data points to determine our position in space."
"The jump drive was not significantly damaged by the jump," Ernt reported happily. "The energy used was within 3% of my estimate. The drive should be capable of performing another jump without trouble."
The Giraffa shook his head in amazement. Perkins waited impatiently while the two pilots worked to collect navigation data, and Irene watched the process. Finally, Derek raised a hand.
"Got it. The good news is we jumped pretty far. The bad news is we are 41 million miles off target."
41 million? Perkins gasped.
"How the hell?"
"The calculations were accurate,"
Tutula stated in a tone that invited no argument.
"The slight battle damage to the banks of Giraptha jump drive coils could not entirely account for such a large margin of error. The Ruhar emulator program must be faulty. Colonel Perkins,"
Tutula unstrapped from her couch and turned to address the human commander.
"We should have enough data from this jump to further refine the emulator system."
"I sure as hell hope so," Perkins kept her temper in check. "Because if we're going through a wormhole, our jump capability needs to be dead-on accurate."
The next jump, 29 hours later, after feverish work recoding the emulator program, delivered much more favorable results. Despite the jump coils not working together properly and them having no way to fix that problem, the second jump came within 207,000 miles of the target. Since the second jump was much longer, Perkins, the pilots, and the cadets involved in programming the jump considered their accuracy a smashing success. Perkins waved her arms to suppress premature celebration.
"Are we in position with the right timing to go through the wormhole?"
"Yes," Irene replied with confidence, pumping a fist that only Derek could see so they could share a private celebration.
"The wormhole will not emerge in this space for another 3 days, and," she checked her display,
17 hours. "That is plenty of time to maneuver the Deal Me In near the event horizon. We have to give the wormhole plenty of room anyway. They emerge in a slightly different location each time."
"Since none of us have ever taken a ship through an Elder wormhole, and probably no one has ever moved a star carrier by a ship on a hardpoint providing the thrust, can we do this?"
"Oh yes, Colonel Perkins,"
Nert spoke up happily, a broad grin exposing his incisors.
"I have observed the process many times. There is no trick to it. We just locate the event horizon and..."
He made a ring of the index finger and thumb on one hand and vigorously demonstrated plunging his other index finger in and out of the ring.
"We go in? It is easy. Oh, so easy."
Emily Perkins had to cover her face with a hand to not burst out laughing. The goofily innocent grin on Nert's face as he made the unintentionally rude gesture was funny. But seeing Irene's face growing beet red as Nert enthusiastically kept going almost made Perkins lose her composure.
"Okay, Nert." Derek reached out to restrain one of Nert's arms. "The ship goes in the hole, and we get the idea."
"Nert is telling the truth, Colonel. Transition through a wormhole is automatic. All the ship needs to do is line up the approach and make sure we don't touch the edge of the event horizon ring."
"What happens if we do touch the ring?"
"Then part of the ship goes through, and the other part..."
Derek ran a hand through the air in a cutting motion.
"Doesn't." "Don't worry, ma'am. Our flight training did simulate a wormhole transition."
Perkins cocked her head. "How extensive was this training?" Her pilots had only been in their starship pilot training for 3 days before the Bosphorok jumped in and spoiled the party. Derek looked to Irene and they both shrugged.
2-3 hours?
Seeing Perkins's eyebrows raised in alarm, Derek added to reassure her,
"Our instructor said there wasn't any point to running that sim much longer because the wormhole transition maneuver is so simple. Jumping into position close to an Elder wormhole is the tricky part. The rest is just normal space navigation."
The three of us agreed to Tula will handle the transition through the wormhole with Irene acting as co-pilot and me calling out navigation waypoints.
Except in this case, the toaster is carrying half a star carrier on its back.
Perkins pinched the bridge of her nose. Irene had noted that Emily Perkins had the honor of being the first human ever to command a starship. What the pilot had not said was that Perkins also had the crushing responsibility of being the first human ever to command a starship. If she screwed up or missed something important, she could get the entire crew killed. Even if at least one cadet survived the disaster, Perkins knew her actions and decisions would be scrutinized under a microscope by a species who overall did not like the idea of former enemies serving aboard their warships.
"Yes, ma'am," Derek agreed, not mentioning that the toaster was technically attached by its belly rather than its back.
"We've practiced maneuvering the combined ships, and we know the flight characteristics of this clumsy beast. Our flight plan," he called up that data on his display, "has us approaching the event horizon at an angle, with the ship's thrust pushing us on a curve into the wormhole. If the engines fail, we will shoot safely past the event horizon and have to try again at another emergence point, but we won't crash into it," he announced with confidence.
"You're telling me that jumping 1,000 light-years through an ancient rip in space-time is the safest part of this journey?"
Irene answered for Derek.
"I know it seems crazy, ma'am, but there's nothing we can do to screw up that wormhole. Everything else we do out here has multiple potentials for error."
Perkins shook her head slowly, knowing she needed to trust the judgment of her pilots, and knowing she had to trust an elder device that no one in the galaxy fully understood.
"Let's hope we don't get a visit from the screw-up fairy. All right. Release the ship from jump conditions and secure for normal space maneuvering."
The transition through the wormhole was as smooth and easy as her pilot said it would be, although she noticed Irene's knuckles turning white from tension as the ship lined up for the approach and flashed through from one part of the galaxy to another. They kept a careful eye on the charge level of the jump drive capacitors, which were getting drained rapidly. By the time they were ready for a jump into the Camp Alpha star system, it was clear that jump would be the Jarraptha starship's last action.
"Ma'am," Irene answered after a team spent 2 hours of checking and rechecking every part of the jump drive system.
"We can jump into the system with a comfortable safety margin." She didn't mention that comfortable meant less than 7%.
"But that will be it. After the jump, the capacitors won't have the energy to get the coils over the threshold for a jump. We'll be stuck in that star system, and the Deal Me In's normal space propulsion system is offline. If we're flying to Camp Alpha, we'll do it in the Ruta Stella."
She used the ship's formal name because her audience included many cadets.
"Understood. We can do it?"
"Yes.
Confidence is high."
Irene ignored the grimaces from some of the engineering cadets.
"We need to," she pulled up their planned course on the display, "jump in here on the near side of the second planet. That will mask our gamma ray burst from being detected on Camp Alpha. It will take 13 days to fly to Camp Alpha. But we can't get the Ruta Stella into orbit there. The reactor will shut down before we get there. The final leg of the flight needs to be in dropships."
Perkins had assumed that would be their best option. The review continued for another hour, partly because there was a large group of people involved in the process of verifying all the systems involved, and they all wanted to weigh in on the decision, so Perkins politely endured the endless rehashing of issues. She also listened because she wanted them all to buy into the plan to set down on Camp Alpha and take shelter there until rescue hopefully arrived. It wasn't a great plan, and there were a lot of unhappy cadets. But no one had a better idea that was realistic, and even Biff grudgingly admitted the ship's failing condition did not offer an option of remaining aboard and hoping for the best. The final jump of the Deal Me In was successful, in that the ship did not explode. They emerged less than 180,000 miles from their target location, and they were not immediately ambushed by enemy starships. Because the jump was draining the last bit of power from the capacitors and the power flow was unsteady, the jump was rough enough to make the toaster's one reactor shut down.
"Let me guess," Perkins tried to keep her own expression neutral as she saw the anguish displayed by Jin.
"The reactor can't be fixed?"
"No."
Relief flashed across Jin's face.
Relief she did not have to argue with their human commander, and she had to admit to herself, relief that she was no longer responsible for keeping a dangerous reactor limping along.
"Well, it got us here. I suppose we can be grateful for that," Perkins said sourly.
"I didn't mean that," she quickly added. "Your ship designers have created remarkable machines. And you and your team," she waved an arm to encompass the exhausted group of engineering cadets, "deserve congratulations for what you have achieved. What you achieved on a real ship in a real crisis. When you get back to the academy, classroom exercises will seem a bit dull, won't they?"
That drew weary smiles from most of the cadets. "We'll need to fly the rest of the way in dropships. It will be a long flight in tight quarters, but..."
"Well, about that, ma'am," Irene waved for attention. "We have a bit of a problem."
"A bit?"
"Colonel," Derek tapped the display in front of him, "Lady Karma has been so nice getting us here and all. I think she wants payback now. There's a group of Kristang on Camp Alpha."
"God," Perkins thought better of taking the Lord's name in vain right then.
"How many?"
"It is difficult to say exactly," Tutula spoke. "The signal is faint. We are picking up short-range surface-to-surface transmissions from a single site that is almost around the curve of the planet. They do not appear to have an active communication satellite. One of the transmissions used a Kristang word that means eight."
She wiggled the four fingers on one hand.
"The speaker complained there are too few of them left. More than eight, but less than 16.
"You get anything else from that transmission?"
"It was one soldier complaining to another about the poor quality of the food, and that they do not expect a ship to return for many months, so they are stuck on the surface. Colonel, I believe they occupy a single small site that is some type of research facility."
Great, Perkins thought bitterly. Karma had indeed been kind to them until that moment.
"Tutula, you keep listening. I want Jates to listen with you so we're not relying on translations that might not be entirely accurate. Cadet Colsoon."
She turned to find the senior cadet who was floating near the rear of the compartment, looking angry.
"Get people loaded into dropships while we select a flight path and landing site. We will come in over the opposite side of the planet from the Kristang base and keep our presence concealed."
"I'm telling you, the human is going to get us all killed,"
Biff whispered from the co-pilot seat of the dropship. He didn't know why he was whispering. The only occupants of the ship were Ruhar cadets.
"She had no way to know," Jin replied as she ran a diagnostic check on the ship's systems from a console at the cockpit's rear bulkhead, making sure the airspace craft was ready for atmospheric entry and flight. She had to rely on painstakingly referring to a checklist on the console because she had no experience with that model of dropship. It was a humbling task, and if she missed something critical or made a mistake, everyone aboard could be killed in the fiery process of contacting the atmosphere.
"It was a possibility."
"It was, and we all knew it."
Jin did not look away from her work.
"There is a small group of Kristang at one site, and Colonel Perkins plans for us to land on the other side of the planet. The Kristang will never know we're here."
Biff snorted.
"Maybe. If we're lucky."
"They didn't spot the route Stella flying past, and that's a bigger sensor signature. They're not looking. We'll be safe as we can be."
"We..."
"What?"
She swiveled her chair to confront the senior cadet.
"What do you suggest? Colonel Perkins gave the only order she could. The ship's reactor was shut down. We couldn't stay aboard. The dropships can't maintain life support for long, not for this many people. Once we jumped into this system, we had only one option. You talk a lot about how leaders have to make tough decisions."
She clacked her incisors on her lower teeth in a derisive gesture because guys like Biff always assumed they would be in positions of leadership.
"The human made a tough decision."
"Not so tough," Biff snapped. "She had no other choice."
"If that's what you think, then what is your problem?"
"This,"
Biff fumbled with how to respond.
"This whole operation has been a mess."
"You could have done better."
It was her turn to sniff. She turned back to her console.
"Even if we do get killed here, we jumped a Jirapha star carrier. None of our people have ever done that."
Along the way to Camp Alpha,
The route to Stella had dropped off flight recorder buoys before every jump and wormhole transition, so any Ruhar ship that found the buoys would learn that the emulation software had worked after a few adjustments.
I don't expect any of us will achieve anything more significant than that in our entire careers. That is better than staying aboard a dying ship in the middle of interstellar space, praying for rescue. That was your plan.
Biff opened his mouth to retort, but he couldn't think of anything to say, so he sat and silently fumed, and hated Lieutenant Colonel Emily Perkins.
Chapter 16
Jates and Tutula had been conferring about something, heads close together in a heated argument, and their Z-phone speakers shut off. When Tutula grabbed the front of Jates's uniform top and shook him, Perkins had enough. "Knock it off, you two. Mind telling me what's going on?" Tutula cast her eyes away in a guilty gesture, so Jates straightened in his chair. "Colonel, with the help of Arlon Dahl, we have penetrated the outer layer of the base's computers." "Outstanding," Perkins grinned. "Good work."
"It is nothing, really," Tutula shrugged. "They made almost no attempt at information security, except for details of their current research project. The security of that system is very robust. We will not be able to gain access from here."
"What's the problem, then? You weren't detected?"
"No, we have not been detected. As I said, the base is not concerned about external security. At the base were 11 security personnel and 28 civilian researchers. All the researchers were evacuated 18 days ago. The 11 guards have one dropship."
Perkins considered that. "Okay. A small contingent, lightly armed, and they don't know about us, right?"
"Correct. It is unlikely."
"Tutula, this will go a lot faster if you get to the point and tell me what was worth you two arguing about." Tutula took a breath and looked at Jates, who shook his head. She ignored him.
"Colonel, perhaps you should sit down."
"Oh, shit," Emily told herself as she lowered into a seat on the somewhat flimsy folding chair in the tent that was the group's headquarters on Camp Alpha. The trip down to the surface had been filled equally with tension and boredom, and they now had the dropships covered with stealth netting, tents set up for everyone, and she had a team trying to hack into the Krystang computers. She would not have risked doing that, except Arlon Dahl had assured her that his handheld computer was more powerful than any type of Krystang system. "Go ahead. Give me the bad news."
"In addition to this planet being a military training site, as you know, it was, and is also, a research base. Even before your military units cycled through this world, the warrior caste brought humans here to study."
Jates urgently shot a warning look at Tutula, which she also ignored.
"To study, and to experiment on. Colonel, this will not be easy to hear."
She related the facts of human civilians being kidnapped from Earth and used for horrible tests of bioweapons, genetically engineered pathogens intended to be used against Earth. Thousands of human subjects had died on Camp Alpha, half a world away from the blissfully ignorant human expeditionary force who had eagerly been training to serve their lizard masters.
"These experiments,"
Perkins asked in a voice flattened into calm from shock. It sounded to her like her own voice was coming from far away.
"How far have they advanced?" "Those experiments were terminated shortly after the wormhole access to your homeworld was shut off. No further supply of test subjects could be brought here from Earth, and the White Wind Clan fell into serious financial trouble when they lost access to Earth. Colonel, I am sorry to tell you that, before the wormhole shut down,
the experiments had proceeded far enough that a supply of that original bioweapon was shipped to your planet to be used against your people in case of rebellion.
The pathogen was still in development, but—"
Tutula tapped the display.
"The report stated it was considered effective enough to kill much of the human population, if needed,"
she added quietly. Emily sat in stunned silence. When Tutula opened her mouth to speak, she raised a hand to stop the alien, unable to process any more information right then. The two Verdgris sat quietly, fully understanding the impact of what they had found.
"Tell me,"
the human asked when she was able to speak. When the Kristang at Earth learned the wormhole had gone dormant and they were trapped there, what would have been their reaction?
We are not Kristang, Tutula reminded gently.
So any guess we make,
they would have shit their pants, Jates stated.
Tutula, Colonel Perkins is a soldier. She needs to know the truth and not some happy stories, he chided his companion. Colonel, your guess is as good as ours, but I am sure you fear the worst. The warrior caste would have panicked at first, then seized the opportunity to make the best of their dilemma by making the worst for your people. With access to effective bioweapons, they could have reduced the human population to a manageable number that posed less of an obstacle to the warrior caste exploitation of your world than enslaved the rest.
A manageable number? Perkins whispered in horror. We don't know anything, Tutula cautioned. We don't. Colonel, you should not.
Thank you, Perkins said robotically, so overwhelmed by emotion that at the moment she felt nothing. Do not tell anyone, especially my team, about the bioweapon sent to Earth. They do not need to know. Not yet. She would need to tell the Mavericks what she just learned, because they would find out when she informed UNF HQ on Paradise, if she ever made contact with Paradise. I assume all human test subjects here were killed? That prompted another meaningful look between the Verdcris. Tutula spoke first.
Those test subjects from Earth were all killed when the experiments were ended, yes. The current problem is that there is another set of experiments ongoing, using human former soldiers who call themselves Keepers?
She checked the translation.
Keepers? Son of a bitch, Perkins exclaimed. Those stupid—
She clenched her fists. Fuming at the stupidity of that misguided bunch was not accomplishing anything. Sorry. Yes, I know about these Keepers of the Faith, as they call themselves. Please, Tutula, continue.
The current experiments are intended not for use against humans, but to use humans as disease carriers. To kill Ruhar. The plan is to infect a group of these Keepers with a pathogen that uses human DNA to create a binary prion agent.
She saw the lack of understanding in Perkins' eyes.
It is a very sophisticated technique. These prion precursors will remain dormant in an infected human for a specified period. The experiment aimed at a dormancy period of 3 months. During that time, humans could infect others with the precursors, but victims would not display any symptoms. In humans, the binary agents would begin combining into a lethal pathogen in 3 months, but in Ruhar, the latency period would be around 2 months. Ruhar could also infect other Ruhar, so the human carriers are only needed to get the infection started, and to provide a cover story, so the Ruhar will think the pathogen is a natural mutation in humans, and not a bio-warfare attack that is, as you know, banned by the rules of this war.
Perkins was stunned. The pathogen could leap from human hosts into Ruhar before infected humans are showing any symptoms of illness?
Yes.
Tutula looked guilty, though she had nothing to do with the project.
As I said, this is very sophisticated and advanced biotechnology. The aim of the research is to produce an agent that appears to be a naturally occurring mutation in humans, a mutation that has evolved an ability to cross into Ruhar. Colonel, because human carriers would not know they were infected, they could infect many Ruhar they come into contact with. By the time the Ruhar are showing symptoms, it will be too late. 2 months is long enough for infected Ruhar to travel to other worlds. This pathogen could spread far beyond the planet you call Paradise.
Oh, shit. Blood drained from Emily's face. This will all get blamed on humans. The two Verdcris showed Perkins the data they had skimmed off the unsecure computer at the Kristang base, which frustratingly did not contain critical details about the pathogen that was intended for an attack on Paradise. To assess the nature of the threat and to prepare any possible countermeasures, they needed the research data that was locked up behind a secure firewall. But Ernt Dahl was not optimistic about his little computer breaking that firewall.
Colonel,
the Jirapta announced after running a subroutine he thought had the best chance of penetrating the firewall.
The attempt was a failure. I am sorry. My system was not designed to penetrate a well-designed firewall.
Is there any other way to get in remotely?
Not that I know of.
Ernt shook his antennas.
We must be extremely careful. If an intrusion is detected, I expect the research system is designed to erase all of its data. I will work with the cadets who have studied what you call cyber security. I must warn you, I am not hopeful.
Then our best hope may be for a Ruhar ship coming to rescue us. They might have experts who can break into that system, Perkins speculated.
Excuse me, Colonel, but I believe that is not true,
Tutula said stiffly.
Arrival of an enemy warship would surely trigger the guards at the base to erase all the research data. The system may even be programmed to erase itself if an enemy ship enters this star system.
Damn it, Perkins chided herself. You're right. You're right, Tutula. Thank you for reminding me. We need to get that data and any biological samples stored at that base while the guards here are unaware of our presence. We need a plan to do that if we can't access that research data remotely. We were able to get schematics of the base layout. However, the base has been expanded repeatedly and many security features are also behind the firewall, Jates warned. We could encounter nasty surprises in any assault.
Understood. There is another problem I have to consider.
She looked first to Tutula, then Jates. I have a dilemma, Perkins explained. If I tell the Ruhar this bioweapon technology exists, they could very well quarantine the human population of Paradise to protect the Ruhar. A quarantine is not your real concern, Jates said as he sat back in his chair.
It is not? Tutula asked.
No. Jates appraised Perkins with a cool eye. If the Ruhar fear humans could be carrying an undetectable lethal pathogen, they may take action to remove the threat. Extreme action.
The Ruhar are not Kristang, Tutula protested.
They are also not stupid nor soft, Jates concluded. When pressed to protect themselves, they have a will of iron. That is why the Kristang have repeatedly suffered defeats to the Ruhar, despite the warrior caste focusing their entire society and economy on war. Humans are still viewed by most Ruhar as conquered and rather pathetic former enemies, despite all your team has done for them, Colonel Perkins. Gratitude has an expiration date. Fear does not. If the Ruhar federal government believes humans on Paradise pose a real threat to Ruhar society on multiple worlds, they will not hesitate to act against a species that is already unpopular. Besides, I do not think you have a dilemma at all, for you do not have a choice about whether to inform the Ruhar.
Why?
Perkins's eyes narrowed. If we destroy this research base and all its materials and data, the pathogen will not pose a threat to Paradise. I believe the human expression is, that ship has sailed. That expression is particularly appropriate in this situation, Jates announced without humor. Colonel, from the data Arlen Dahl was able to extract, we learned that a Kristang transport ship departed this world 18 days ago, carrying the bioweapon and a group of keepers who will be infected without their knowledge. That ship, he paused as Perkins felt a sinking feeling, is on its way to Paradise right now.
The Kristang might have killed everyone on Earth?
Shauna asked as tears rolled freely down her cheeks. Perkins had told her team about the bioweapon threat to Earth before she explained the need for a physical assault on the Kristang research base to counter another and more current bioweapon threat.
Hey, darling, we already knew that could be true, Jesse said quietly as he held Shauna's shoulders tightly.
His own face was a mask of anger, but his eyes were moist, and he didn't care if anyone saw.
Yes, but now we know that was their plan all along.
Shauna balled up her fists.
They build a bioweapon, then they shut down the wormhole so they can do whatever they want to Earth without Max Hulks or Rindaloo enforcing their stupid rules. By the time the Kristang open the wormhole again, humans will be extinct and no one will care.
Whoa, Dave gasped.
You think the lizards shut down that wormhole?
Shauna, I do not think that is true, Irene declared.
Word at UNEF HQ was the lizards were totally surprised and freaked out when the wormhole to Earth shut down. They didn't expect that to happen. Hell, if the Kristang can control elder wormholes, they would use that ability for something more important than our little planet.
Maybe they didn't shut down the wormhole, Shauna snapped at her friend. Maybe they just somehow anticipated that wormhole was going to shut down and they planned for it. It doesn't matter. The lizards have control of Earth. They have a bioweapon, and no one can stop them from doing whatever they want.
All right, all right, Perkins appealed for calm. Jared, I hate the goddamned lizards as much as anyone, but right now we need to focus. We have a job to do.
What's that, ma'am? Jesse asked, startled out of his dark thoughts.
A dumbfuck group of keepers are on their way to paradise, and we have no way to stop them. But on this planet at the research base, is data and materials the Ruhar could use to create a cure or a vaccine or some way to protect against this bioweapon. We need to retrieve that data and hold it until a friendly ship arrives to pick us up.
We can, she thought for a moment.
Yeah, we can, we should, load the data into a drone that will respond only to a Ruhar or allied ship in case a Kristang ship gets here first and wipes us out,
Perkins noted, thinking it strange that the prospect of her own impending death was so relatively unimportant. She felt no fear for herself. Shauna wiped away tears with the back of her hands.
Ma'am, I am in. Point me at that base, and no goddamn lizard is going to keep me from getting that data.
Perkins accepted Shauna's statement with a grim nod.
Tutula, Jates, what about you?
Attacking that base would be taking direct action against your own species.
I know the warrior caste are not your people, but...
Colonel Perkins, Jates thumped the console with a fist, hard enough to shake the tough equipment. Taking direct action, taking the fight right to the warrior caste, is the reason why we are out here. If needed, Tutula and I will hit that base by ourselves.
That won't be necessary, Irene assured the two Verdgris.
Ma'am, we've got plenty of anger and determination. What we need is a plan. We can't take any Ruhar with us on the assault. There's too much risk of infection, even if we stay buttoned up in skin suits. The Verdgris aren't at risk of getting sick or being carriers, right?
Tutula nodded, so she continued.
Then we have to hit that base with the six of us, two Verdgris, one Jirapta, and a couple dropships. We need a plan, and we first need to know the opposition.
So, she turned to the aliens. What do we know in terms of tactical intel?
Ma'am? Dave asked with a sideways glance at the other four Mavericks huddled around a console and reviewing a schematic of the enemy base.
A word?
Perkins nodded and waved the sergeant to where she was in a cabin seat working on her tablet.
What is it?
Dave lowered his voice.
We know this planet was used to research and test bioweapons for use against humans on Earth.
Perkins cleared her throat that had become constricted by the thought of unimaginable horrors afflicting the population of her home planet. Her original home planet, she reminded herself bitterly. Earth was lost forever to her now, whether humans still lived there or not. Paradise was her home world now.
Yes. My question is...
He ran a finger on the armrest of the chair next to Perkins and showed her a fingertip stained yellow with fine dust that blew in whenever the dropship's doors were open.
We're all breathing this air. Could the bioweapon they plan to use on Earth be loose here?
God damn it, Perkins swore, keeping her voice low.
I didn't think of that. Yeah, I didn't either until a minute ago. We know the X-Force didn't get infected while we were here, so the lizards must have kept the weapon contained before the Force shipped out to Paradise, but after that, the lizards must have tested the effectiveness of air dispersal at some point. In that case, he looked at his dust-covered fingertip, we could all be exposed and infected.
Shit.
Colonel,
Dave shot a guilty glance forward, where the only other four humans on the planet were struggling with their own problems.
If we have been exposed to that bioweapon, we need to move up the assault schedule. We need to go before the six of us become combat ineffective, and that could be real soon.
Chaika,
This is why the United States Army in its infinite wisdom has sergeants. Ma'am? To remind dumbass senior officers like me of practical considerations that I should have thought of. I've had my head in the clouds worrying about goddamn policy, like how UNEF can keep the Ruhar from enforcing extreme measures against us on Paradise to protect their own furry little asses. You just remind